on my discussion of puja or ritual worship as a form of mystical prayer yesterday, and keeping up with the tradition we have established here of beginning with a mystical prayer, I decided to perform a little puja myself here so that it gives some idea of what actually a puja involves. And again, this is done in both homes and temples. In temples, you only offer the flowers or whatever little things you get for the deity. In your home, you perform the entire puja, beginning with picking up, which begins with picking up flower and getting the water and everything necessary for puja. So I'm just going to perform a little puja here myself. This is the water that you clean the glass, the container yourself, and get the water in the container. And then there is this image. All I have is an animated image of Lord Shiva here, which I always keep with me. And what you do is generally by, it's a form of giving the deity the bath.
नागेन्द्रहाराय त्रिलोचनाय भस्मांगरागाय महेश्वराय नित्याय शुद्धाय दिगंबराय तस्मै नकाराय नमः शिवाय शिवाय गौरी वदनाब्जवृन्द सूर्याय दक्षा त्वरनाशकाय श्रीनीलकण्ठाय वृषध्वजाय तस्मै वकाराय नमः शिवाय वसिष्ठकुम्भो भवगौतमार्य मुनीन्द्रदेवार्चितशेखराय चन्दार्कवैश्वानरलोचनाय तस्मै यकाराय नमः शिवाय रत्नैकल्पितमासनं हिमज्वले स्नानं च दिव्याम्बरं नानारत्नविभूषितं मृगमदा मोदङ्कितं चन्दनं जातीचम्पकबिल्वपत्ररचितं पुष्पं च धूपं तथा दीपं देवदयानिधे पशुपते हृत्कल्पितं गृह्यताम् सौवर्णेमणिखण्डरत्नरचितं रात्रेयुतं पायसं भक्ष्यं पञ्चविधं पर्योदधियुतं रम्भाफलं पानकं शाकानामयुधं जलं रुचिकरं कर्पूरकर्णोज्ज्वलं तम्बूलं मनसा मया विरचितं भक्त्या प्रभु श्रीगुरु करचरणकृतं वा कायजं कर्मजं वा श्रवणनयनजं वा मानसं वा अपराधं विहितं वा सर्वमेतत्क्षमस्व जय जय
I think it needs to be explained, and in the light of our discussion last night, I think it is necessary. And I chose to. Puja is generally a very personal experience, even when it is done in a public place like a temple. As Bharat pointed out yesterday, it's a very personal experience. And but I think in order to bring out what it involves, I need to discuss it. So that was a very short version of the puja. That generally my puja at home involves about at least 45 minutes to an hour. But that was a very brief, abbreviated version of puja. And as I said earlier, it begins with purifying your own body, ritually purifying everything that you are going to use for the puja, and then giving, usually it is a shrine, it's a separate place in the house, and some people have really beautiful decorative shrines made out of wood or metal and at home. And when you go to the temple, it is the garbhagriha, the inner sanctum, is where the priest is performing. It's all cleaned up with the water that you have. Now you get it from the tap. But generally, which you have brought from the well yourself, and then cleaning up the sacred place. That's where it begins. And then cleaning all the utensils, cleaning, and then offering flowers, offering of, there are many offerings, offering of food, offering of what is called aarti, offering of light, lit lamps. There is a ritual that involves you go in a movement like this before God, offering him all the, I don't know, it is offering of light to the God. And then singing, chanting the mantras as I was doing. And also that was in Sanskrit, and it basically meant that I really do not know the mystery. I mean, I have not mastered the rituals. I do not know how to perform the puja properly, perform the puja, the worship properly. All I know is that I want to offer everything that I do in my life at your feet. And this is just a gesture of what, where I am directing my life. So, it could be a picture and it could be a statue, metal image. There are many metal images which, when you first get it, it is just a piece of metal. But then there are rituals to sanctify it, and it is called prana pratishtha, which is inviting the deity to be in that image. And by inviting the deity, and with a faith that deity will accept your invitation, and then after that ritual is performed, then the deity is understood to be present in the image. That is the mystery of his presence. He can, the divine, which is the cosmic presence, and presence in everything at the same time, being transcendent and immanent at the same time. That is the paradox of divine presence, that according to the Hindu tradition, that no one is able to understand. That is the mystery of his being, that it is that he is or she is or it is at once transcendent and immanent in the world. It is not different, but like what Graham talked yesterday about paganism, everything being alive, even it is the, again I have to go back again and again to this word bhava. And the word that I wrote on the board, bhava, the emotional and the spiritual state, which gives you the ability to see the divine in everything. And that's why even that rock could be, with proper bhava, even that rock can be seen as a little bit different, in the sense that I cannot go, and philosophically I can understand that he is everywhere, in everything, present in everything, but I can't go and make connection to everything at the same time. It is, I have to have a window, I have to have something to focus on, something where I can make that connection, and I can touch him. I can make that connection, I can touch him. The picture and the, through the picture, the divine. I cannot go, and at the same time since we are limited, and since we have limited number of time, and since our way of seeing is essentially limited, I need a limited manifestation of the divine, where the God, and that's how the image is seen. It is there. Because God is leaving. No. Right. Until you stop doing the puja. Until you stop doing the puja, the worship. Right. No, there is. But for 5 months from now, I decide that I don't no longer want to worship this particular image as the divine, as the manifestation of the divine. And in many temples this happened, when the God, because the communities left the town, or because the temple is destroyed, or whatever happened, and the temple is out of use, or in the same way the image is out of use for ritual worship, and it remains unworshipped for a long period of time, then that it has to be re-sanctified. There are variety of ways which are prescribed, and the individual chooses what is best, what best fits their temperament. I worship Shiva, but there are people who will worship Krishna. There are people who will worship the goddess. Well, I am a little bit weird for in the Hindu tradition. I am not your typical Hindu, but most people, there is a concept called Ishta Devata, which is the favorite deity. The people who worship Shiva will not necessarily deny the existence of Krishna or goddess, but choose to worship Shiva as their favorite deity, and would think of Shiva as the ultimate, and the others as manifestations of, or aspects of, Shiva's creativity. Well, it depends on what you call hybrid, because I think the way I see it is this as many layers of Hinduism, because the same people who are going to, it's true, as I mentioned this yesterday, that just as these philosophical and metaphysical systems were developing, at the same time there was also integration of a lot of indigenous traditions, which of goddess worship, tree worship, or even rock worship, into Hinduism, and these two got kind of blended at a point. So there is a layer of Hinduism which can be considered animistic paganism, and then there is a layer. But I wouldn't call it hybrid, because I think it is authentic Hinduism. Okay.
No, that's why I wrote this down. And this is where I am beginning. And I think I thought the discussion stayed with me all night. And I have been thinking about it in many different ways and trying to understand the arguments and the questions and a lot of help that I got from the discussion from various people. And these are the things that came out from people in the discussion, and those are the ones I want to use for clarifying. And
it means, you know. And now you sit down and you meditate the way the modern day sects of mystics like to do, going back to the falling back on the earlier tradition. Nilima has such pujas almost regularly, and she has to offer everything to deity, so her husband is also offered. I too have to sit with her. And I have difficulty separating my role as a worshipper and as an ethnographer, you know, at times, which is a big problem I have when I go to religious places, and I'm honest about this, you know. She meditates then for 15 minutes. Sometimes it goes on for half an hour. We don't utter a word. Initially she's singing, then she chants. She might just use one mantra. And there is absolute silence for 10-15 minutes. Nilima has not told you this because she doesn't want to go into all the details. Her focus is something else, I suppose. My grandfather used to do that, you know. We had what you would call very high church ceremony in the house. There was a huge shrine, there's a puja room, and I like to think Hindu temples are more like Catholic consecrated shrines, you know, as he said, you know, that they are consecrated. If the idol, the image is defiled, we don't worship, you know, then, you know. It's defiled, you know, by some people, you know, from outside, you know, or you have done that something to that image yourself, you know. Like in very impure states you have been to the image, you know. You have ignored the image, you have not performed things properly, you know. You have to do some penitence for that and try to bring back the level of consecration, you know, to the shrine, you know. It's a rather complicated thing. You are not talking about just worshipping a stone here, you know. You are dealing with a very elaborate tradition, you know, here, you know. And there might be hundreds of books about that and discussions, you know, in the scholarly world, you know, of the Hindus, you know, which some of them have now come to light through the work of anthropologists and students of history of religion, you know. But the mystical things, you saw that for a few minutes Nilima also just meditated, you know. So there is that element also, you know. It's not that by offering the flowers that you are having everything, you know. I think that's a rather impression, you know, wrong impression we get, you know, because you are doing this in a short time, you know. You're offering a lot of other things to the deities, and each time with great intensity you're bringing that, you know, that, you know. And that, I think, is something I wanted to draw your attention to, you know. There's more to this than it looks like, you know, in a way. Having said this, I will allow Nilima to say what else you want.
Yeah, because I have very little time, and I will greatly appreciate if we can keep the comments and the questions to the end. I will leave a few minutes for that, because I want to talk about mystical poetry. But before that, I have to briefly comment on my reflections on our discussion last night or yesterday in the afternoon. As I said, the discussion stayed with me all night. And more than any, the discussion that we, not much. No, actually it's very good. I mean, I think I enjoyed it. And so it was, in a way, it was a kind of blessing, because it made me clarify my own thoughts. And the phrase that stayed with me, I had to ask that question over and over to myself again, more than anybody else. And that was the phrase, anything goes, that just stayed with me. And I had to ask myself, was I proposing a kind of vulgarization of what we understand to be profound and deep and ineffable? And if, or if by being accessible to everyone, the ritual of puja becomes that. And that took me back to an anecdote which I did not have time yesterday to tell, and which I had meant to tell, from Vasudha's tradition, Sri Vaishnava tradition, which takes us to the heart of bhakti. And that is not vulgarization of mysticism, but democratization of mysticism. And there is an anecdote which is told by acharyas or teachers to their students who are being trained to become teachers of the community. And that is, the earliest known acharya, or the great teacher of that tradition, Vaishnava tradition, who Sri Vaishnava tradition of South India, who worship Vishnu as the Supreme Being. The first teacher, named Yamuna, Yamuna was a profoundly mystical man, and he was looking for somebody to pass on his knowledge too, as the teacher, the next teacher, his successor. And during his lifetime, he could not find anybody who was appropriate to take this position. So he waited all life. Now here is a teacher who is waiting for the right disciple. And it is kind of a role reversal, in the sense that generally what we think about is a disciple looking for the right teacher. He is looking for the right disciple, doesn't happen. But he knew, he came to know about this man called Ramanujacharya, who became the greatest teacher and philosopher of that tradition later on. He was just a priest in a small temple. But Yamuna had heard about him and asked his disciples to go and get him to Srirangam, which was the headquarters of the tradition. They went, but by the time they came back, Yamuna had already died. And was so Ramanuja and Yamuna never met. So Yamuna gave the most secret teaching, the mystical teaching of the tradition, to someone else, and told him that you will not understand the mystery of this, but whatever I am telling you, tell that to Ramanuja, and he will know the mystical aspect of that. So anyway, Ramanuja arrived, and he was taken to this man, got his teaching, but the person who passed on that message and that teaching to Ramanujacharya told him that this is the most secret, most esoteric, most mysterious teaching of the tradition, and don't tell this to anyone without knowing the worthiness of that person. You can pass it on only to very few. And that is the instruction Yamuna gave to me also. I only could pass it on to you. Ramanujacharya said yes, and then he went next day, stood in the gallery of the temple with thousands of people, I mean hundreds of people around, and loudly pronounced that teaching to everyone. And the man who passed the teaching on was furious, and he summoned Ramanujacharya. Ramanujacharya went and said, "Do you know what you have done? Do you know what the punishment for this is?" He said, "Yeah, I'll go to perpetual hell for this." "And so why did you do this?" And Ramanuja replied, "If by my going to perpetual hell, everyone else has access to this most profound teaching, then I think that's reward enough." And that is the spirit of bhakti. This is 11th century. Now Ramanujacharya, I'll talk a little bit about this Sri Vaishnava tradition, because that is a tradition which is based on, which brings me right back into my topic today. It is a tradition which is based on poetry of the saint poets who were called the Alvars. This word Alvar means the one who has immersed, the one who has immersed in the name of God, the one who has immersed in the love of God. And the Alvars of South India, they sang their songs from the 7th through, roughly from the 7th through the 9th century. And then there was no theology or philosophy until that time. The entire tradition is based on the song of the Alvars, the ones who were immersed in love of God. Singing those songs is a big part of the liturgy at the temple, at home, and they are of very highly mystical nature. I'll read a few from the greatest of Alvars called Namalvar, from whom I read a little bit yesterday at the poetry session. And in their theology, the biggest principle is that of prapatti. The word means total surrender. And the surrender of the self, of individual will, takes one to a state where one is able to declare, to say to God that, "Look, I really don't know anything. And I don't know if I'm capable of knowing anything. All I know is that you know what I need and what is good for me. And I'm just going to surrender my will to you. And I leave it to you, what you want to give to me. Whether you want to bring me closer to you, whether I am still not in a state where I can get closer to you, it's all up to you. But it is through my surrender that I'm making this plea, that, or making a statement, that what I need and what I want is union with you." And it is now, because this is a part of the liturgy, now I just want to refer to this few words that I have written here, which came up from what Bonnie said, from what Meyer said. Bonnie used this word potentiality, and Eva Gwenny and Meyer used the word transformation and intentionality. Bharat pointed out the personal dimension of Hindu puja, and Magdalene talked about response from the divine. It is when there is, you may do everything, but it is only when you feel that there is a response from the divine. It is he or she who has also the power, really the power, to make what a prayer is, a mystical prayer. And so, and then I was talking to Dana later on, and it all brought things together. I think I was not clear enough when I said every prayer is a mystical prayer. What I meant was, these are meant to be mystical. The purpose is mystical. It does not mean every performance of it is going to be mystical. And what I was trying to bring out is the authenticity of the mystical experience of common people. And of people, what is interwoven, what is not separate from everyday life, but what is interwoven in everyday life, and what gives you the space, the means, to create that silence just through rhythm. You start falling into that rhythm. That rhythm creates a space for, if you want, question of intentionality and the question of transformation are extremely important. And if you want, it can happen. It can turn into a mystical prayer. Having said that, I'm just going to the tradition of mystical poetry, because that is at the core. Mystical poetry has remained at the core of all devotional traditions in both South and North India. And I'll begin by, I found two really nice passages, very short, which explain, one from Vasudha's book, The Way and the Goal, where she brings out that really it is not the goal that is of ultimate importance. It is the way. The way and the goal are the same. They merge. It is the process and not that state alone that is important. So actually I want to read a little bit from the last section from the Darshan book. It begins with, in the last section, it begins with one again, and I'm here on page 10 and 11 in the book, and page 4 and 5 in the handwritten things. The really last section. I'm going to read a little bit from Darshan. No, Darshan. Seeing the sacred. Oh, okay. Yeah. Page and 4 and 10 and 11. Yeah. I'm beginning from 9. I'm starting from 9. And it is she's talking about visiting the gods and looking at the divine images. And the paragraph starts with, Sanskrit poets and dramatists convey the subtleties of meaning expressed by the glances of the eyes, not only between lovers, but between husband and wife, whose public conversation was limited by rules of propriety. They communicated in their glances, writes Daniel H.H. Ingalls. One must suppose that the language of the eyes was more advanced in ancient India than it is with us. Gonda reflects on the language of the eyes, as it may pertain to the religious context. It is indeed hardly conceivable that the psychical contact brought about in normal social intercourse by the eye should not consciously or unconsciously have been made an element in a variety of rites and religious customs. That the positive fascination of a prolonged look. Fixed regard or other manners of looking should not, in ritual practice also, be a means of expressing feelings, of imposing silence, of signifying consent or satisfaction, of expressing will, love or reverence, a means also of participating in the essence and the nature of the person or object looked at. Not only is seeing a form of touching, it is also a form of knowing. And then Diana Egg goes on to say, a few lines later, we speak of seeing the point of an argument, of insight into an issue of complexity, of the vision of people of wisdom. In Vedic India, the seers or the sages were called the rishis. In their hymns, collected in the Rig Veda, to see often means a mystical, supernatural beholding or visionary experience. Having said that, we go to the realm of sound, which is the realm of poetry. And I'm going to read a couple of poems from Namalwar and then go quickly to two poets from North India whom I read yesterday, Meera and Kabir. And again, when all this is developing, I want to also, I cannot emphasize enough that there are two parallel trends in Hindu mystical traditions. And that is, one is the path of knowledge, the path of meditation and yoga, and just confining everything to your own self, to your body, to your meditation, to your concentration. And then there is this another path of bhakti or surrender, where there is a kind of democratization of the mystical prayer, and where the union with the divine is understood to be like a union in relational context, not in the context of merging, in the context of a relationship. And so these two are going parallel. And a lot of people from each tradition are critical of the other way, other path. But they have been very strong, and in both the ways have been very strong in the Hindu tradition. And Meera, on her side, is the ultimate example of a love in terms of relation. And Kabir was a proponent of bhakti or devotion, dropping off everything that one could see, just concentrating on the divine within one's heart, which is going back to the path of knowledge, going back to awareness, going back to the yogic traditions. Okay. Now, a couple of things that are going on with the Alwars, like Namalwar, is that this process of democratization is going on at various levels, and one of them is dropping off some